Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jimmy Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. Well, if you're dreading Labor Day and the unofficial end of summer, imagine if you were on the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction, also known as the Super Committee. Those 12 lawmakers get to work after the holiday on cutting the nation's deficit over 10 years by $1.5 trillion, a task deemed impossible by the Congress as a whole. So who are the six Democrats and six Republicans on the Super Committee, and were they given superpowers to come to an agreement? Scott Montgomery, CQ Roll Call Editor-in-Chief, joins me now to take a closer look at the group, and I welcome you to WNYC.
Thank you very much for having me. Good morning.
Well, I guess Congressional Quarterly is definitely the place to go for answers about whether this can work and how it's supposed to work. But first, let's start with who. We've got six senators and six House members, each split evenly along party lines. Can you give us the list?
Sure. Let's walk through it real quickly. You have the committee is going to be led by the Democrat Patty Murray, senator from Washington, and the Republican Jeb Hensarling, Republican from Texas, a House member. They are an interesting pair. She is known as a pretty liberal senator from the left coast, as we like to say, right? And Jeb Hensarling is known as a pretty conservative guy. He has not had a reputation as a deal maker, which would not seem to bode well. So they share the job as co-chairs. And then also on the committee is John Kerry of Massachusetts, Max Baucus, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee from Montana, John Kyle, Republican from Arizona, Rob Portman, Republican from Ohio, and Pat Toomey, a Republican senator from Pennsylvania, a freshman former House member. On the House side, the rest includes Dave Camp from Michigan, who is now the chairman of Ways and Means Committee, and Fred Upton, who chairs the Energy and Commerce Committee, also from Michigan. Then Chris Van Hollen from Maryland, who is the budget top Democrat on the Budget Committee, and James Clyburn, who is the number three Democrat in the House from South Carolina, and Javiera Becerra, who is the number five Democratic on the House side.
All right. And these folks were appointed by each chamber's party leadership. But do you see any common threads? What kinds of expertise will they bring to the table working with their commonality or despite their differences may be the way to ask the question?
Yeah, you know, it's a really interesting mix, and it's hard when you look at these people to see where leadership thought they might find a group that could work together. There are only really, if you look at the House members in particular, you've got these guys like Dave Camp and Fred Upton and Jeb Hensarling. These are not, these Republicans are not known as deal makers particularly. They're not known for working especially well with Democrats in the past. And the same is true, conversely, for the Democrats on the House side, Van Hollen, Clyburn, and Becerra. These are fairly partisan people who have not had a great reputation for crossing the aisle to work together. I think that what's really going to be interesting for us to look at is there are two, I think, pivotal players in this whole thing. One is Max Baucus, the senator from Montana. He is a longtime dealmaker. He's a Democrat but has worked well with Republicans in the past. His claim to fame most recently is that he was the guy who really did a lot of the writing of the health care reform bill that was passed. Mm-hmm. And then the other interesting guy is Rob Portman. Rob Portman from Ohio, former budget director for the last President Bush, has a real strong background in Washington and is actually known not as a partisan. He's conservative, but he's also known as a guy who really does get along well with Democrats. Those two guys could be the ones who are pivotal to a deal.
Yeah, and as you point out, the significant factor here will be their ability to work together and across the aisle, and to the extent some have a track record on that, it will be significant. Four were on the Simpson-Bowles deficit reduction panel, right?
Mm-hmm.
But voted against
the plan. Right, the final deal.
And I guess that was because of proposed cuts to entitlements, is that right?
On
the Democratic side, I guess the Republicans, it would have been because of tax increases. So we're back to the same old problem we've had all along.
Exactly. And that's why there is an argument to be made that in the end, they may get no deal and that we may wind up with the triggers.
Yes.
You recall that they have until November 23rd, right before Thanksgiving, to come up with a deal. If they don't come up to $1.5 trillion over 10 years, then $1.2 trillion will be cut automatically beginning in January of 2013. And if that $1.2 trillion cut would be made essentially 50-50 between defense spending and other domestic programs. And so there's an argument to be made that, you know, they may just live with that.
Well, let me ask you about the instability in the financial markets,
mm-hmm.
especially in the last couple of weeks. And this morning, stocks fell sharply when markets opened. Does that add some impetus to the committee actually coming to some agreement on a plan?
Well, you know, you would think so. But what's been interesting to see so far is that Congress has been remarkably, I hesitate to use the word indifferent, to what the markets are doing, but they certainly seem not to be terribly concerned about it. As we all saw, they were willing to take the debt ceiling debate right up to the wire, which for weeks played havoc with the markets, and they were willing to do that. So I'm not sure that they're going to be motivated now. And you could argue that going the route of the triggers is in some ways a more mm-hmm. predictable way to go anyway.
Yeah, if somewhat surprising to common sense thinking lay people. And all the Republicans signed Grover Norquist's pledge never to raise taxes, while Democrats are speaking of an arguably balanced approach, which to their mind means revenue increases as well as spending cuts. And that gets us back to what tripped up the full Congress from taking action, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. It's worth remembering, too, though, that they only need a majority vote on the committee, so seven people. Doesn't need to be uniform, doesn't need to be unanimous. And there is some room, and that's where you get back to guys like Portman and maybe even Pat Toomey. Pat Toomey is an interesting guy from Pennsylvania, freshman senator. He was he has a background in, he was the leader of the Club for Growth, which is like the Norquist group that you just mentioned that does the anti-tax pledge. The Club for Growth is a very strong anti-tax group, and that is where he sort of hails, you know, ideologically. But he also has said that cutting subsidies for industries like ethanol is not a tax increase. So there might be room mm-hmm. for a guy like him to say, you know, if the net benefit is that we are not raising taxes overall, but rather are eliminating some subsidies for different industries, that's the kind of thing he might actually go along with.
And none of these senators were part of the so-called Gang of Six.
No.
Right.
In fact, it seemed like leadership tried to stay kind of deliberately away from them to start with a fresh group.
Is there any significance to who is not on the super committee? I noticed that Paul Ryan was expected to be appointed, but he's not on the committee. So, Scott Montgomery, what's your thought about the names that are missing from this list? It's always hard to talk about things in the negative, but can we make draw any conclusions from that?
Well, you know, it really is difficult to know what the thinking was behind the leadership choices they made. What is clear is that they did not choose a group of people who, as we discussed earlier, are, it's not a bunch of deal makers. You know, it's not a group of people who have backgrounds in cutting deals. Even somebody like Patty Murray, who comes from the Democratic side of things, her other job is that she is the leader of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. Her what she's working on when she's not doing this is helping get Democrats reelected in 2012. Keep in mind that whatever this committee does is going to have to be passed by the House and passed by the Senate. So you can bet that she is not going to sign on to something that will make difficult votes for the vulnerable senators she's got running in 2012.
I actually have a couple of comments on my Twitter feed about the diversity. One person seeing this as a relatively diverse committee, and others complaining that it's not diverse enough. I see Patty Murray. That's a woman. And on Capitol Hill, there are not too many from choose. And I see some degree of ethnic and racial diversity. Can you comment on that?
Well, that is a criticism that has been leveled, that was brought up from the very beginning, that it was really going to be important that the committee reflect some level of diversity. And Nancy Pelosi, the leader of the minority, the Democratic Party, did sort of at the very last minute, and I don't mean to suggest that that was a result of pressure or anything, but the last couple of names she put on the committee were James Clyburn, who is African-American, former civil rights leader, and Javier Becerra, who leads the Hispanic caucus. It would seem that you could do more than two people of color on a committee of 12 in Congress, but I suppose one might argue that that's kind of better than nothing. Both of these gentlemen are in leadership in the Democratic Party, so they already have kind of standing. And Clyburn, in particular, has an interesting background in that he has something of a relationship with President Obama. They've golfed together, and he's known to have sort of a back-channel relationship with the president.
I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. My guest is Scott Montgomery, editor-in-chief at Roll Call. Scott, as you know, Brookings has looked at past committees like this and how successful they've been. And a lot of what determines success or failure has to do with the rules under which they're formed. The base closing committees were successful, for example, because Congress didn't have to approve their recommendations and could vote them down. And other committees could only recommend solutions, and they failed. The super committee seems to fall somewhere in the middle.
Right.
So say a little bit more about what kinds of superpowers they have, if any, and how that may help or hurt the chances of success.
Well, you know, it is. I think that's a great question, because it's absolutely true that the rules that you set for groups like this have everything to do with how well they can perform. In this case, they did not invest this committee with a whole lot of superpower, as you put it. They can vote out their recommendation by simple majority, but it must be approved on the floor in the House and the Senate. So nothing they do here is done until it's passed by both chambers, which is certainly a significant thing. It's not like it goes straight to the president. And the other thing to keep in mind, too, is with the way they set it up, you know, the big sword that's supposed to motivate them to cut a deal are these triggers, right? If they don't have a deal, then automatically a $1.2 trillion cuts over 10 years go into effect. But those don't go into effect for a full year, January to 2013. So there's nothing to say that this committee couldn't fail in its role and then have the whole Congress spend the next year tinkering with the job, with the spending cuts that are set out in the trigger. So you could see where this ends up amounting, frankly, to a whole lot of theater.
And how does that work out in terms of the election cycle, Frank?
This could end up being something that gets done in an election year. In other words, if they did if they allowed the triggers to go into effect, there would be an enormous amount of pressure throughout Congress to tinker with the cuts that are in those triggers, because the they deliberately created those cuts to aim at defense and at health spending, two of the most powerful lobbies in Washington. So you can bet that the most powerful lobbies in Washington are poised to pressure the committee as it exists. And should the triggers be cuts be put into effect, you can expect that those lobbies will spend the coming year, an election year, pushing very hard to change those numbers to better suit them.
So, Scott, do you think that Republicans might think they would have more to gain from the committee's failure or from its success?
You know, I've heard
given the election cycle.
I've heard it argued both ways. I've heard it argued that, you know, in the end, it's not a terrible thing for Democrats. They don't, you know, I mean, spending cuts in health care are kind of painful, but Medicare goes, you know, although providers lose something, Medicare as a program goes untouched. Half the spending cuts come out of defense. Maybe that's as good a deal as the Democrats are going to get in the current environment anyway. Maybe they should just let it happen. I think Republicans are much more motivated to strike some sort of a deal because, presumably, they're more concerned about the heavy emphasis of cutting that would be struck on defense.
And what are the possible outcomes? They come up with a plan, it gets accepted. They come up with a plan, it gets defeated. Are there any other possibilities middle of that?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that we're hearing now that President Obama plans to make a proposal in the next couple of weeks, a very specific proposal, kind of an outline for the committee to work off of. They'll have no obligation to use it, but he's going to try to get ahead of it. He's now saying that he'd like to see this committee also as part of its mandate, if you will, take on some job creation. I think that you know, the most obvious scenarios are that they strike some sort of a deal where they essentially come up with $1.5 trillion in cuts that maybe does a little tinkering with some tax incentives, but avoids getting into a big tax reform kind of a debate. I think that they might like to do that, but there just isn't time. So they could do some sort of middling deal. But I think actually the most likely scenario, if I were to guess right now, is they don't come to a deal. The triggers go into effect, and we spend the next year arguing over the cuts that are in the triggers.
I'd say that's a safe bet, Scott Montgomery. All right. Thank you so much, Scott, for being with us.
Very glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. We will leave it there. That is Scott Montgomery. Of course, he is the CQ Roll Call Editor-in-Chief, talking with us about the Super Committee on Deficit Reduction. This is the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Jamie Floyd, filling in for Brian this week. Up next, John Walker Lynn's father says it's time to release his son.